Uxbridge was so overcrowded that, after drawing a couple of blankets from stores, most of us slept, toe-to-toe, on hard boards, 8 to a bell tent, rows of which had been hastily erected on the grass surrounds outside the permanent barrack blocks. After filling in endless forms and undergoing a medical examination, I finally ended up on the third day in a line of recruits queuing up behind the desk of an elderly and harassed-looking officer. Here the interview was short and very much to the point. "Have you got an OTC certificate, eh?" "Yes, sir," I replied, producing the document, "from Wellington." "Excellent, then I will put you down for officer aircrew. Report next door." The unfortunate recruit behind me, while no doubt a very worthy young man, did not have this certificate, and I just had time to hear the officer say, "You are recommended for NCO aircrew." The process next door was similar, except that the officer asked me, "What category of aircrew do you wish to volunteer for?" "Pilot, sir." "Sorry," he replied, "we're not taking pilots this week, only air gunners. We will inform you later when there are vacancies for pilots." As I didn't have the price of a return railway ticket, I stammered, "All right, sir, I'll volunteer as an air gunner." On such rash spontaneity can one's fate be settled, and I was accepted by the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve on the 12th of June 1940, for the duration of the present emergency. I hadn't the faintest idea what an air gunner was supposed to do. Leaving Uxbridge, I was sent the following morning to Bridgnorth for formal induction into the RAF. At Bridgnorth I was sworn in, kitted out, immunized against every known disease, drilled and generally mucked around for a month. It was also my first experience, but not the last, of the jealousy and dislike of aircrew cadets by the regular NCOs, who tried every way of intimidating and bullying them without resorting to physical violence, although on occasion they came very close to it. The sudden flood of recruits following the defeat in France had caused a blockage in the training pipeline, so from Bridgnorth I was posted to an operational bomber station at Rafflinton-on-Usk in Yorkshire for on-the-job training. This station was equipped with Whitleys, an ancient twin-engined bomber which flew through the air tail down like some ungainly tropical insect. Its crews grimly joked that it took off at 90 miles per hour, climbed at 90 miles per hour, cruised at 90 miles per hour, and then landed again at 90 miles per hour. My days were spent in the armory dismantling, cleaning and reassembling the aircraft's defensive armament of Browning .303 machine guns under the watchful eye of a senior NCO. Occasionally I flew a sortie in the rear turret when there was a shortage of trained air gunners. This experience quickly led me to the conclusion that I had joined the wrong trade. The rear turret was a long way downhill from the busy social and active life at the front end. Not only was it cold and lonely, but, due to the elongated tube of the fuselage, the cramped turret rotated and vibrated like an unbalanced and crazy Ferris wheel. I quickly appreciated that the rear gunner was the lowest form of air crew life. The other crew members seemed miles away, and one longed for some sort of communication with them, if only to say a brief goodbye. The pilot was a very superior sort of fellow, pampered by the rest of his crew, so I rapidly made up my mind that it was far better to be a pilot than an air gunner, a distinction then as distant as a shop assistant from the floor manager. Our family solicitor, Dudley Appleby, had joined the Royal Air Force at the beginning of the war, and at that time was staff officer to the Chief of Air Staff in the Air Ministry. Taking the bull by the horns, I rang him up and explained my predicament. He must have been in a position of great influence, because within a fortnight I was remustered to cadet pilot, which meant that I wore a white flash in my fore and aft cap, and was posted in October, 1940, to the initial training wing, ITW, at Aberystwyth for a month's basic training. At Aberystwyth we were housed in the hotels and guest houses stretched out along the seafront, which had been requisitioned and stripped of furniture and fittings for the duration of the war. From that time until the end of our training I never seemed to move except in a body of men under the orders of an NCO, and personal privacy became just a memory. The heroic exploits of the few in the Battle of Britain had so fired the imagination of the young that the cream of the public schools had flocked to join the Royal Air Force, who welcomed them with open arms to top up their depleted fighter squadrons. Consequently, the company I kept at ITW was not far removed from that in the sixth form at Wellington. My particular friends were all straight out of their public schools: Robbie Beresford Pierce, Arthur Innes, Lloyd Davis, all Etonians, Ken Burley, Eric Masters, John Ashford and Tom Lattice, the only older member of our group who at 27 and with a real moustache seemed positively ancient. We had a picture taken, posing proudly in brand's new flying kit, by an admiring local photographer much more familiar with snapping holiday makers on the front than aspiring knights in armour. Of this group, Lloyd Davis remained a close and dear friend until he died in the tangled wreckage of a car just after the war, following a head-on collision with another vehicle while driving down the main runway at Rafsilt in Germany, taking a shortcut to the officer's mess after a midnight bathe. A light in my heart went out. The rest of them disappeared into the pit of war. Our training was based on a pre-war syllabus sandwiched so much in time that I completed my ab initio flying on Tiger Moths in just 1 month between 5th of October, 1940, and 5th of November, 1940, at No. 22 Elementary Flying Training School, Cambridge. This unit was really Marshall Civilian Flying School, where all the ground instructors and some of the flying instructors were civilians. There were one or two RAF officers, but most of the other service flying instructors were sergeant pilots who vented their dislike of officer cadets by indulging in a variety of aerial indignities designed to induce violent vomiting in their students. From Cambridge, some of us went on to No. 3 Service Flying Training School at RAF South Cerny with the Airspeed Oxford, a twin-engined aircraft which, together with its civilian sister the Envoy, was built by Airspeed at Portsmouth. This was a great disappointment to us, as, in company with all the young men of the time, we saw ourselves as dashing fighter pilots. The twin-engined Oxfords meant that we were most likely destined for bombers. My flying course began on 8th of November, 1940, with my instructor flying Officer Froy, French, who was a most delightful and civilized person. We immediately began instruction on the Oxford, which was then used extensively for most categories of aircrew training. It was powered by two G2X radial engines. These were fine, provided that they both worked at the same time, but on one engine the Oxford was a sod. The first hour or so of dual instruction was taken up with trying to manage the awkwardness of single engine flying. However, after 3 hours dual I was dispatched off solo and managed to steer my aircraft around the regulation square circuit, careful never to let the airfield out of sight, and finally perpetrate what can only be called an excuse for a landing. As November gave way to December, the weather began to get worse and worse, covering the Cotswolds with thick, clammy low cloud and fog, giving a taste of the appalling weather to come in that second winter of the war. During the halcyon summer days over Cambridgeshire, with the Battle of Britain being fought above us to the south, I had enjoyed flying the Tiger Moth in the manner of a club pilot, safe but neither bold nor brilliant. But now coping with the Oxford in foul weather was quite a different matter, and I began to realize that acute fear and flying were frequent companions. Accidents happened when you least expected them. Events leading to a disaster seem to come in threes: the weather deteriorates, the radar develops a fault, and finally the engine fails. You are left in extreme fear on the back of a bucking Bronco which is determined to unseat you. I had just read a book called Some Practical Experience of Flying by Hamel and Turner, published in 1914. Although written in the earliest days of flying, it became my faithful companion. There was one particular passage in the chapter on aptitude for flying that I took to heart. The popular idea that the man without fear is the man to become a great flyer is entirely wrong. Most of the best flyers are men who are keenly apprehensive of possible danger, who never forget the presence of danger, and who have a very wholesome dread of the many causes of disaster. Nor are any of the best flyers men who no longer value life. The reckless, as well as the vainglorious, man may shine for a while in the aerial world, but his career will be very brief. Unfortunately, Gustav Hamel did not take his own advice, since shortly after his book was published, he collected a new racing monoplane in France and, despite warnings of a faulty engine, took off for Hendon. This great and gallant pilot was never seen or heard of again. Shortly after reading that book, I learned my lesson the hard way. Indeed, it was a false sense of security that led me into a trap and a lesson that I shall never forget, that elements and machines have a habit of ganging up on unwary pilots and, unlike a car, it is not possible to get out and walk. One of the exercises we were required to undertake was an instrument flight cross-country. On this exercise, the first student pilot flew the aircraft from the left-hand seat and, having settled down on course, the second student pilot in the right-hand seat, acting as a safety lookout, pulled a black cloth over the pilot's head, rather like a perambulator hood, who was then required to fly around a triangular course on instruments. On the flight in question, I was authorized as the safety pilot to a fellow student called Wisely Wickham. The weather forecast was not good, overcast with broken rain clouds at 1,000 feet over base but deteriorating to the east along our route. However, as it was good enough to take off, our instructor authorized the flight with a warning to retrace our steps if the weather got too bad. Accordingly, we splashed across the muddy airfield, bounced into the air and climbed to 4,000 feet where we found a narrow tunnel with reasonable visibility between two layers of cloud. Wisely set course and began flying on instruments while I kept to look out for other aircraft. The weather did get worse as we flew east, and after a while we began to fly over a solid dark layer of low cloud with the visibility deteriorating all the time. I warned Wisely of the worsening situation and pulled the hood back so that he could look for himself. After a short discussion, we decided to continue on flight plan, which would eventually bring us back to somewhere in the vicinity of base. We had just turned onto the second leg of our cross country when we both simultaneously saw wireless masts ahead sticking up like cocktail sticks through the fog. Their sudden appearance quite unnerved Wisely, who turned to me with his usual oath and said, "Christ, we must get down." I did not dispute his decision, as all pilots know that when faced with the unusual there is an overpowering temptation to get back into contact with Mother Earth as quickly as possible. He pushed the stick forward and we were soon speeding down through a thick, black soupy fog, 1,000 feet, 700, 500, 400, 300, 200, 100 feet, and suddenly the ground rushed up to meet us. Wisely just had time to pull out and with another loud, "Christ," stabbed the undercarriage down and began to run his wheels at over 130 miles per hour along what appeared in the fog to be a grass field. Another interesting fact about situations where death and destruction appear imminent is that events seem to slow down like the images flickering in the individual frames of a slow-motion film, so that a haystack seemed to only loom leisurely out of the mist. I desperately tried to pull the aircraft over it, but with a great lurch we struck it with the port wing. While the blow reduced our forward momentum, we nevertheless sped on minus a wing and engine until we broke through a hedge, this time shedding the starboard wing and engine. Crossing a road, the remains of the aircraft climbed up another tall hedge on the opposite side before we finally came to rest hanging 20 feet above the ground, still firmly strapped in our seats. What was so surprising was the total silence as we sat there without speaking, each wrapped in our own private thoughts. I had been conscious of two very powerful emotions: first, a sickening fear of the unknown as we dived down through the fog, which was followed almost immediately by a fierce excitement when we hit the ground. How long we sat there I do not know, perhaps just a minute or so. I was woken up from this reverie by another great shout from my friend, who uttered with his usual brevity and clarity of speech, "Christ, thank God we're down." I pushed back the perspex window of the cockpit and looked down onto a grass verge below. A little old lady came into view and stood beneath the window looking up. "Are you all right?" she cried. "Yes," I replied. "Would you like me to go and fetch you a cup of tea?" "No, I said, I don't think so at the moment. Before I could say anything more, she turned about and walked off. That was the last I saw of the old lady, but the vision of her toddling gaily off into the fog swinging a large carrier bag remains firmly planted in my memory. Perhaps she often came upon aeroplanes perched perilously on the top of hedges. Stiffly and painfully, since we were badly bruised from the jolting we had received, we climbed out of our seats, picked our way through the wreckage and dropped to the ground. Still in our flying suits and helmets, we walked down the road in silence. After about half a mile, the lane led into a main road with a public house on the corner. Approaching the building, the landlord emerged from the main door wearing a heavy old army greatcoat. He looked at us, startled, and said, "Are you English?" To which we answered in the affirmative. He looked much relieved and continued, "I heard the engines of your plane coming down through the fog and of a crash. Do you come from Raffabingdon?" "No," we replied, "but can we come in and use your telephone?" He led us into the bar lounge, but no amount of trying could raise an operator on his telephone. This was not too surprising, as I did recall seeing a lot of wires draped around the wrecked fuselage, and we must have pulled all the telephone lines down in our progress across country. Fortunately, Raffabingdon, just a mile or so down the main road, had also heard the noise of our engines and sent out a search party, which found us happily downing our third free whiskey. We were taken back to their sick quarters and then returned by ambulance to South Cerney. Under normal circumstances, we should have been suspended from flying for writing off a valuable aircraft, but such was the demand for aircrew at that time that our punishment was very light, confined to camp for a month, a red endorsement in our logbooks, and whenever there was time between sorties, we were dispatched to run a lap of the airfield perimeter in flying kit complete with parachute, an exhausting and very undignified exercise. The winter of 1941 was an appalling one even by English standards. The airfield became a bog and every flight a struggle against low cloud, rain, snow and ice. Not only did the weather turn against us, but the Germans did too. They began to mount intruder operations in Hainkeleys against RAF training bases, diving out of low cloud and strafing the airfields with bombs and guns by day and night, chasing any luckless student they found in the air. We started night flying in January, which necessitated flying our aircraft over Bybury, a subsidiary airfield, in the late afternoons. We laid out a line of gooseneck flares and waited for the weather to clear enough to start the night flying program. Night after night we sat around in coldness and huts, huddled over the one wood stove and fortified by tin mugs of tea, only to return to South Cerney at dawn having achieved nothing. One night, after laying out the flare path with my old friend Wisely Wickham, we were walking back to the crew hut when the inevitable Heinkel came down the flare path, spraying us and the parked aircraft with machine guns. We both hurled ourselves under the nearest vehicle for cover and, when we finally emerged, found it was the petrol Bowser. I felt destined to end my days in Wisely's company, but at least he seemed on good terms with Christ. Eventually I managed an hour's duel on 10 February and a month later a further 45 minutes duel followed by 3 solo night landings. That was the extent of my night flying training. As the course drew to an end, the excitement of our future fate mounted. I quite enjoyed flying the Oxford and had begun to look forward to heavy bombers, although both Lloyd Davis and my own first choice would still have been fighters. When our postings came through, I just could not believe my eyes. After all, my friends and I were still 19 and desperate to get into the fighting war, and we talked about little else. Now 3 of us were posted to No. 2 Central Flying School, Cranwell, on an instructor's course. We were average pilots and had no experience of operations. It was impossible to imagine how the decision to make us instructors had come about. The only attribute that I could see was that all 3 of us could talk proper, and perhaps they thought at least our future students might be able to understand us. Most of my fellow students were posted to bombers, and almost all of them were killed in the Battle of Germany, so perhaps in the end we were the lucky ones. Flying instructor. On 10th of April, 1941, we reported to the Rough College, Cranwell, conspicuous in our brand new uniform with one very thin stripe on our sleeves, but nevertheless very proud of our pilot's flying brevet. Although the cadets had long since departed, the atmosphere and many of the trappings remained. Efforts had been made at camouflaging, but the main college buildings and towers stuck out like a sore thumb on the flat Lincolnshire landscape. Rumour had it that Goering, an admiring pre-war visitor, had given his Luftwaffe instructions not to bomb Cranwell. The officers' mess continued to be run on strictly pre-war lines, and the old civilian servants were still there to look after a new and quite different type of young gentleman. There was no bar, and you rang a bell in the anteroom for a mess waiter to bring a drink. A quiet sherry before dinner just about set the scene, and pilot officers were expected to be seen and not heard. However, there were a number of old lags on my course straight from fighter command and the Battle of Britain, and the normal peace of the anteroom occasionally erupted into a riotous party, when the permanent residents would be driven out. The flying was also fairly gentlemanly after the rigors of the previous winter, and we practiced giving instruction, called patter, through a long rubber tube to each other on the single-engine Avro Tutor, which was the standard RAF trainer of the 30s. And then on my old friend and adversary, the Oxford. We were required to fly our aircraft to their limits, including aerobatics in the Oxford. I managed to execute a barrel roll quite satisfactorily with my instructor, Flying Officer Strauss, a South African with a hare lip and a pronounced lisp. "Now," he said, "I will demonstrate it." Whereupon he opened the throttles fully, dived the aircraft to gain the necessary speed, and then with both hands hauled firmly back on the stick. Up we went, passing the horizon with the nose going higher and higher until we reached the vertical. At that point the Oxford gave up the unequal struggle, hung for a brief moment before falling back again down the same steep path, throwing dust and an accumulation of loose articles all over the cockpit. My courageous instructor was not to be defeated, and in an even firmer voice cried out, "I will now demonstrate to you how to the Oxford." The exact maneuver was repeated several times, with Flying Officer Strauss becoming more and more excited, until I thought the aircraft must fall to bits. He finally gave up with a disconsolate sigh, "We will twee and up another day, the engines on this aircraft are rotten." We never managed a loop, as very shortly afterwards the tail came off an aircraft on the same exercise, crashing and killing the occupants, and the Oxford was declared non-aerobatic. The course finished on 23 May, and I became qualified to instruct on multi-engine and elementary type aircraft. I did not have to travel far to my next posting. Indeed, I kept the same room in the mess. Together with Lloyd Davis, I became a flying instructor at the RAF College Flying Training School, which used the South Airfield, whereas CFS had used the North Airfield. On 6 June I collected my first clutch of eager students and began instructing them on the Oxford, which I had hardly mastered myself, and certainly not at night, since I had only gone solo once, and getting up and down again on a black night was still an adventure for me. We did our night flying at a subsidiary grass airfield called Barkstone, very similar to the setup at Burford, except that the Germans gave us even more trouble by harrying the bomber and training bases in Lincolnshire. Quite a lot of the time of a junior instructor was spent at the end of the line of goosenecks, controlling the takeoffs and landings of aircraft, using an Aldous lamp giving green or red signal lights. While I was at Cranwell, one new instructor gave a green for an aircraft on the approach to land, which it duly did, and taxied around again to the takeoff points. The instructor gave the aircraft another green for takeoff, and it was only when it turned into wind on the flare path that he saw with horror the huge swastika on the fuselage of a Heinkel. I suppose even Germans had a sporting sense of humor. I soon learned to understand what it was like to be an instructor. In the early stages of the course I lived and breathed circuits and bumps, with my pupils hitting the ground in every conceivable attitude, from which I tried to extract the aircraft without crashing. However, I eventually got my fledglings off solo. We then started the night flying phase, and between myself and my students we managed to avoid enemy action and somehow get the aircraft around the circuit and down on the ground again in one piece, until in desperation I again sent them off solo. They seemed to cope rather better without my help. Yet Bark's tone in the grey light of dawn was like a scrapyard, with Oxford sticking out of every hedge. In 1941 training command was breaking more aircraft than the manufacturers could produce. We had not been at Cranwell very long when I discovered that Dudley Appleby, who had already been so helpful to me, had forsaken the Air Ministry for the pleasures of the countryside and was now the personal staff officer to the Air Officer Commanding at AOC, of the training group whose headquarters were also at Cranwell. Lloyd and I called on Dudley one day and he insisted on introducing us to the AOC. I had never seen anything higher than a group captain before and trembled in the presence of such an important officer. He turned out to be a most charming person and immediately extended an invitation to dinner the following week. Driving to the AOC's residence a few days later, some 10 miles away, we exchanged thoughts which were remarkably similar. Wouldn't it be something if he had a beautiful daughter? And he had, a 17-year-old ravishing creature. Lloyd was an extremely good-looking tall Etonian with the most delightful and polished manners, so it came as no surprise when they fell in love and I was relegated to the position of a useful decoy to allay her mother's suspicion of any foul play. One morning Lloyd awoke me pale and distraught. "Peter, old friend," he said, "we're in terrible trouble."
"What do you mean?"
I asked. "Last night there was an awful row at the AOC's. June confessed to her mother she had missed her period and that I was the culprit. Madam is furious."
"Lloyd," I replied, "what do you mean, we're in trouble? It looks as though you're the one in trouble, not me."
"Well, my old sport, it appears you and I are bracketed together in this deal and we are required to report to the AOC's office at 10 o'clock this morning." At exactly 10 o'clock, one aged flight lieutenant and two young pilot officers stood stiffly to attention before their AOC listening to a resume of their characters which was quite unprintable. The interview concluded with the information that all three of us were suspended from duty pending posting. The outcome was that poor old Dudley Appleby, whose only crime had been to effect the initial introduction, was posted back to the Air Ministry from which he had striven so hard to escape. Lloyd was posted to Rhodesia and I, who had enjoyed none of the pleasures of the encounter, was given a posting to No. 36 Service Flying Training School SFTS, Penhold, Alberta. And then of course it all turned out to be a false alarm, a mere hiccup in the menstrual cycle and the young lady's period picked up again happily on time. But Lloyd and I were separated not to meet again until after the war when we were both married, and he was soon to be killed. I had come to realize quite quickly that I enjoyed a distinct advantage over the boys straight from school, toughened as I was by months at sea working amongst the roughest of sailors. It was not that public school boys were not tough, on the contrary, if Wellington was any example the opposite was true, it was just that the attitude taught by public schools, a strict code of honor and behavior, may have been all very well on the playing fields of Eton but was not conducive to survival in the kind of war and against the kind of enemy we were being trained to face. While I did not purposely avoid danger, I was instinctively more keenly aware of the trouble spots and the right timing required to play rough when the going got tough. In retrospect, I am sure that a lot of these young men were killed before they really knew what had hit them. Later on, as the voracious appetite of Bomber Command hungrily began to consume aircrew, the type of recruit changed altogether. By the time I became a flying instructor, the type of recruit had already begun to change from the young school leavers to middle-class professional people between the ages of 25 and 40, with a consequent reduction in medical and physical standards. Unfortunately, we also began to get a type of recruit attracted by the glamour and uniform of the RAF, but who had no intention of going into action or getting hurt. This could be achieved by being just good enough to reach the end of the course but then ensuring a failure on the final flying test before being remustered to yet another branch of aircrew and so repeating the process for as long as possible.
This small number became quite easily recognizable by their smart turnout, slick manners and well-trimmed mustaches, but the RAF soon caught on to their tricks, classified them into a group under the heading of LMF, lack of moral fiber, and posted them to a special unit. When I joined up, the RAF was not the meritocracy it had become when I left 35 years later. The pre-war class system was easily identifiable. The Cranwell officers were the elite, with the short service commissioned officers well down the social scale.